Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Something that concerns me when I look at whites in the Western world, from America through to Europe, but especially in America, I find myself marveling in a horrified way at how other races are shunting whites around, especially in America, given the population of the United States, where whites are about 200 million, and to see how these small groups of non-whites, how they mess the vast majority of whites and all of white society around. I find it quite horrifying when I look at it. Now, of course, the whole issue is that these non-whites, this includes Jews, that all of them say that they are minorities. And so everybody knows that white Americans are the majority. And so the twist that these Jews have brought to society is to say that minorities mustn't be shunted around. Minorities also have their rights. So now white power cannot just go and do to the minorities what they think is right. And these minorities are allowed to do all kinds of things. And of course, the lowest retards of them all are the blacks. And it's quite horrifying, some of the stuff that comes out of the mouths of blacks. America is built on the Roman Republic, and it's meant to be a place where everybody can take part in society and people are allowed freedoms, especially free speech. So one could say, okay, in such a society, you allow everyone to say their say. You allow people to go out and say what they want to say. Because at the end of the day, everything will be resolved through discussion. So even if you've got these bozos who come and who say all kinds of crazy stuff, it's simply a case that the white majority will quietly and calmly take their time and debate these total morons and retards, and then quietly push them in the right direction that is best for the country. So these retards can come up with all kinds of things. Like I've heard some of these black Americans say that they need territory of their own. And I just laugh at that because they would never be able to look after themselves. They'd be poorer than they were before. And they themselves are so used to capitalism and the shopping mall that I cannot see these blacks being able to look after themselves in any way. And the white elite, the white bureaucrats, the whites in government know how much power they've got. And they know that these blacks are really completely stupid and that these kinds of ideas won't fly. But they don't go and take these blacks and throw them in jail or shoot them. They try to deal with their silly minds and let them have their chance to say their say and do their thing. Of course, the key drivers behind most of the racial strife in America, as everywhere, are Jews. And they are doing it for malicious purposes, to set the one against the other, and basically to work against the whites as a whole. But it's quite terrific to see the kinds of thoughts that come out of the mouths of these non-whites. Now, in some cases, you get a black eye like Malcolm X, where Malcolm X isn't owned by the Jews, unlike the scumbag Martin Luther King, who is owned by Jewry. Malcolm X starts doing his own thinking, and he actually goes down a path that actually makes sense. He becomes a black racist, and he's trying to teach his people. But his people are a small portion of the United States. And the best that he can do is to turn around and say, oh, well, the whites are screwing us in this way, the whites are screwing us in that way. But the truth of the matter is that no matter what the whites are doing, these blacks in America have got the greatest opportunities, the most freedoms, and access to the best infrastructure of any blacks on the planet. But with some prodding and all kinds of Jewish nonsense going on behind the scenes, these blacks can come up with crazy, crazy stuff. So take a look at this image on the screen in front of you. Here's the leader of BLM. BLM, and she was saying that whites are subhuman genetic defects. Possibly she's basing this on the out of Africa theory notion, where the whole line of thinking is that all humans came out of Africa. So she calls whites genetic defects. But maybe the real problem is them, because even if the out of Africa theory is true, the fact of the matter is that we whites evolved out of that to become what we are, whereas they hardly evolved at all. They were the ones that were stuck back in time. But anyway, she comes and she talks her nonsense, and BLM is assisted in many ways to do lots of violent stuff. But we're not going to go into that today. But it's quite horrific to see the kinds of things that these blacks are allowed to say. Whereas any white who says even a tenth of what they say, or a tenth of what Jews say, a white would be in huge trouble. Now, I do understand that America is a strong country and it's on the world stage, and America's got its own foreign policy. And these are things that I'd like to tackle later as well, to look at America a bit from a distance, from a higher perspective. So I do understand if white Americans were to say, let's go and slaughter all the blacks and get rid of all these minorities, then the rest of the world would be horrified by it, and then all the other blacks in the world would be against America, and diplomacy would be impossible. That is really what this ultimately boils down to. These minorities in America are used in many ways as a stick with which to beat white America. And the way in which it becomes a problem is that if white America maltreats the minorities, then white America has got a diplomacy and trading problem with the rest of the world. These minorities are in many ways used, most likely by Jewry, they are used as a way, literally, for Jewry to blackmail America. Because the notion is, if you treat the minorities badly, then you're just a Nazi like Hitler. And then they're going to go and they're going to scream to the whole world, and all the blacks who run black countries, especially the entire African continent, all of these blacks are going to side with America's enemies. These blacks are not going to want to trade with America, etc. This is the basic means by which these stupid minorities become a real weakness for white America. Though there are white Americans who use these minorities as a way to pretend overseas, you see, we also got black people, and our black people can come and talk to your black people. But all these things about race and what these things mean is something I'll deal with later. I want to come back to the issue of the value of a person, the value of a man. So for America, white Americans have to see to it that they treat all these miscellaneous rubbish minorities well because of diplomacy and foreign enemies. These minorities, when I look at them, seem to me to be more trouble than anything else. But if there was one time when I was quite horrified at what was happening in America, it was after those rubbish George Floyd riots, which itself is all stage nonsense and a whole bunch of lies about what the police were doing. The cops are constantly under attack. And so you had all these non-white buffoons running around, engaging in lots of violence and that kind of thing, and everyone making threats. But the thing that was to me the worst thing of all that whites did was, if you look at this screen in front of you, you'll see a white cop kneeling in solidarity with this George Floyd nonsense. I can't remember who gave the orders exactly, but these things happened, and white cops had to then sort of stand down and kneel because of the anger of these blacks. When I saw that, that really bothered me, because here in Africa, Africa, when I look at Rhodesia and South Africa and the whites, I must tell you that when you go down this path where you start backing down to others, that this leads to problems. A guy who spoke a lot about this was Ian Smith of Rhodesia. Ian Smith of Rhodesia used to talk about appeasement, appeasing the others. And Ian Smith used to say over and over again that if you appease others, that it's a slippery slope, and that as you appease them, you are weakening your position, and they are going to exploit this more and more. Ian Smith was very much against appeasement. He's probably the politician who brought it up the most often of any white politician. And this kind of thing that you see this white man doing, this is wrong. But liberals and Jews will tell you, no, 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 this is right. This is right. You need to have all these silly moralistic values. But in reality, this is very bad. And the reason it's very bad is because whites do not understand and do not fully appreciate how other races look at them. And that is what we're going to deal with today. I want to show you something about other races, mostly blacks, actually. 90% of what I'm going to show you has to do with blacks, but this extends to other races. America is a very interesting country, and I've been sitting and pondering many aspects of America. But there are some things that white Americans should notice about themselves. White Americans should notice that never at any time ever is there any kind of discussion that Americans want any other territory other than the United States. White Americans are only concerned with America, and America is very big. And despite the power of white Americans will never say, what if we went to another continent and we conquered some territory in that continent and made that territory a part of America? White Americans never think in those terms at all. But whites in Europe had an empire that covered most of the world. So there's a disconnect between European thinking and American thinking. Because for America, America is big enough. And never at any time will you find anywhere in the thinking of the elites, in the thinking of the military, etc., never at any time is there any thinking about what if America expanded. So keep in mind that the American mindset is composed of the fixed borders of the United States, as if it has to remain like that until the end of time. Just keep this in the back of your mind, because it's something that I want to revisit, because it's something that no American will ever think of. Like, America could have trouble with Haiti or Cuba or Mexico. Never at any time will there be thinking that says, why don't we just invade Cuba, smash the place, and make Cuba another province or another state of America, and then we'll settle it with people from America. That kind of thinking does not exist, because America sticks by certain values. So America might go and get a tiny little island somewhere and build a military base there, and they'll do it because that's how they can project power. But they'll never think of meaningful territory that could be added to America. So I just want to make that clear as something that the American mind never considers. Whereas in Europe, in the time even before Hitler, there was the concept of Lebensraum, living space, the need for additional space. So America doesn't need additional living space at this time or any time in the near future, but other whites may need it. However, America's politics, its economics, and its military thinking is all caged inside this concept that America is what it is, and it will not grow in size at all, except for the odd military base that sits on a tiny little island somewhere. So just keep that in the back of your mind. Because if you limit your mind and you cage your mind and you limit yourself to principles like these, in the distant future, there could be opportunities that you could have seized or things you could have done. Things you could have done physically because you have the power to do it. But by putting your thoughts in a cage, you now have have a weakness. If you look at the Romans and other ancient whites, we never had that issue. Prior to Christianity, whites saw conquest and expansion as a good thing. And the only time that they really worried about borders is if they've got someone else who's very strong, who's a neighboring nation. But I just wanted to make it clear that there is this limitation in the American mind. And it's kind of strange because Americans are themselves conquerors. White Americans are Europeans who went and conquered a whole continent. But strangely, despite white Americans being the greatest conquerors in the history of Western civilization, all of a sudden, the boundaries are now are fixed and they've conquered an area and that's it. So part of the weakness of the American mind then becomes all these other people, blacks, Jews, and all other minorities, because to deal with them, they have to be dealt with at a distance through diplomacy, through trade, and some military action at a distance. And this actually becomes a big weakness, because now you are allowing others in other parts of the world, no matter how weak they are, you accept that they have some kind of rights there. But our ancestors would never have thought in those terms. And I just want to make that clear to you, that it's something that Americans should sit and ponder more about yourselves, because there are many other issues that come out of this. Because as some of you know, I really like Ben Clarkson's thinking, Ben Clarkson of creativity. Ben Clarkson said that whites should take any part of the earth that we feel we need, and that's that. Ben Clarkson did not have limitations on our thinking, and neither did Hitler. In Hitler's original 25-point plan, Hitler actually demanded colonies. He demanded colonies. So today, we're going to take a good, hard look at a whole bunch of fighting in Africa, much of it from Rhodesia, but also from somebody I recently introduced you to. I did promise you in that Gods of War video about von Lettow Vorbeck that I'm telling you all these things about von Lettow Vorbeck because there's a very, very important lesson that you're going to learn. And today you're going to learn that lesson. Today I'm going to show you something that I cannot impress enough upon whites. This is a lesson that otherwise would be totally forgotten. It would disappear away in history, and whites in the future will be at a very, very big disadvantage for as long as they believe liberal and Jewish junk. So there on the screen on the left is von Lettow Vorbeck. As you remember, his incredible campaign in World War I in German East Africa. This man pulled off the greatest guerrilla warfare campaign in the history of the world. Nobody did guerrilla warfare better than von Lettow Vorbeck. But von Lettow Vorbeck had an army of Germans and blacks, Askaris. And this is where we're going to start looking into racial stuff. On the right, you can see a French Alouette gunship from the Rhodesian War, most likely even a South African donated one, since most of the Alouettes in Rhodesia eventually came from the South African Air Force. I think it was in the 1960s that the South African Air Force went and conducted a study, and they looked around for helicopters. And they settled on this French civilian helicopter, the Alouette 3, and they bought a whole stack of them. I think they bought something like 75 of those helicopters. And later in the Rhodesian War, they lent the Rhodesians about 50 of those helicopters. And those helicopters fought so much in Rhodesia and in South Africa and in Southwest Africa and Angola. Those freaking French helicopters did such an amazing job. But in Rhodesia, without those helicopters, we'd have been gone. Those helicopters saved our lives, I tell you. But today you're going to hear more about the Rhodesian Air Force. And you may find it strange that I'm going to tell you about the German von Letta Vorbeck from World War I and the Rhodesian Bush War, and specifically the Rhodesian Air Force, because you're about to learn a very fascinating lesson that otherwise would be lost to history. And the vast majority of people would not even notice this. However, I'd like to start with a little bit of music and a little bit of fun. So I'm going to give you two musical pieces. The first one is a song, and it's a song that's from the time when the German Empire existed and when the Germans had colonies. And the song is Higher Safari. It's sung in German. Underneath it are the words in English and in French. And you'll see some pictures there that relate to German East Africa, to von Letta Vorbeck. And you'll see that they're singing about the Askaris as well, the black troops, the Askaris, that von Letta Vorbeck commanded. That'll be followed by a little tribute to Rhodesia. So you'll get a song and some film footage about Rhodesia, get a feel for Rhodesia. Take note of the toast at the end of the video and see who's at the dinner table, and you're going to see all white males. Rhodesia is a white country. It is ruled by whites, and whites want power. And then we'll get down to the business of learning some lessons.
When I was but a young man, I was wild and full of fire. A youth within my teens, but full of challenge and desire. I ran away from home and left my mother and my dad. I know it grieved them so to think their only boy was bad. I fell in with an outlaw band, their names were known quite well. How many times we robbed and plundered, I could never tell. This kind of sinful living leads only to a fall. I learned that much and more the night I heard my master call. One night we rustled cattle, 1,000 head or so, and started them out on the trail that leads to Mexico. But a norther started blowing, and lightning flashed about. I thought someone was calling me, I thought I heard a shout. Then at that moment lightning struck not 20 yards from me, and left there was a giant cross where once there was a tree. And this time I knew I heard a voice so sweet and strange, a voice that came from everywhere, a voice that called my name. So frightened I was thinking of sinful deeds I'd done, I failed to see the 1,000 head of cattle start to run. The cattle they stampeded were running all around. My pony ran but stumbled and it threw me to the ground. I felt the end was near, that death would be the price, when a mighty bowl of lightning showed the face of Jesus Christ. And I cried, oh Lord, forgive me, don't let it happen now. I want to live for you alone, oh God, these words I vow. My wicked past unfolded, I thought of wasted years, when another bowl of lightning killed 100 head of steers. And the others rushed on by me, and I was left to live. The master had a reason, life is his to take or give. A miracle performed that night, I wasn't meant to die. The dead ones formed a barricade, at least 6 or 7 high. Right behind it there was I, afraid but safe and sound. I cried and begged for mercy, kneeling there upon the ground. A pardon I was granted, my sinful soul set free. No more to fear the angry waves upon life's stormy sea. Forgiven by the love of God, a love that will remain. I gave my life and soul the night the Savior called my name.
Gentlemen,
okay, let's get cracking. There are a couple of things that I want to tell you and show you today, and then we'll bring all of this together, because this is a very difficult yet critically important lesson that I want to drive home to all whites. This lesson is very important for the future. And if you stay in the liberal mindset, then whites in the future are going to struggle to come right with other races. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read from Wikipedia to give you a bit of background about the end of von Letta Vorbeck. What happened at the end after he'd surrendered to the British and it was time for him to return to Germany. So this is from the Wikipedia page. Letta Vorbeck agreed to a ceasefire at the spot now marked by the Chambeshi Monument in present-day Zambia, which I showed you in the last video. He was instructed by the British to march north to Abercorn to surrender his army, arriving there on 25 November. The remains of his army at the time consisted of 30 German officers, obviously whites, 125 German non-commissioned officers and other enlisted ranks, also white, 1,168 askaris and 3,500 porters. Remember, he needed porters to carry everything because they couldn't use vehicles. After hostilities ended, the British transferred the German POWs to Dar es Salaam, that's the big city on the coast, for eventual repatriation. Letta Vorbeck made several efforts to secure an early release for his askaris, who were in a POW camp at Tabora. Now listen to this. Before Letta Vorbeck was separated from his askaris, One of them cried out, "I have been asked to say this to you, Bwana General. Where do you go now? Where you go, we will go with you. And if this is not the time, then wait until my son grows up to be a warrior, and he will take my place and go with you. We will go with you, Bwana General, will we not?" Then it says, Robert Gordy writes, "To a man, the Askaris stepped forward, ready to follow the commander to the ends of the earth. But von Lettow held them back with a gesture and kept on marching. His war was now over." Now, in Africa, the term Bwana means sir or master or boss. Sir or master or boss. So they are saying things like honorable general or boss general, etc. It is therefore a term of respect. They are looking up to him and they want to follow him. So keep that in mind, because we will return to this. Let's continue reading, because there's something else that happens with von Lettow Vorbeck and the blacks long afterwards. Reading from the Wikipedia page, post-war. Lettow Vorbeck returned to Germany in early March 1919. To a hero's welcome. He led the veterans of the Schutztruppe in their tattered tropical uniforms on a victory parade through the Brandenburg Gate, which was decorated in their honor. He was the only German commander to successfully invade the British Empire during the First World War. As I mentioned, he also successfully invaded and left the Portuguese territory of Mozambique. And that victory parade is clearly with his white troops. If you look on the screen in front of you, you can actually see a photo of the victory parade of von Lettow Vorbeck. There he is on his horse, and you can see the white men who are marching with him. These are the veterans of the East African campaign. This is the only German victory parade after World War I. Let's continue. He remained in the Reichswehr despite attempts to involve him in the politics of the Weimar Republic. 14 months after his return to Germany, Lettow Vorbeck commanded the troops that ended the Spartacist uprising in Hamburg. Let me pause there. That was some Jewish communist bullshit that was going on there, that Spartacist uprising. Jews were busy trying to get Germans to kill Germans. There was quite a bit of fighting inside Germany after World War I, as Germans were trying to stop Jewish communist rebellions and stuff. There was big trouble there. But let's just continue on. However, Lettow Vorbeck then lost his commission in the Reichswehr in the summer of 1920. Following his involvement in the Kapp Putsch, he subsequently worked in Bremen as an import-export manager. In June 1926, Lettow Vorbeck met Richard Meinertzhagen in Bremen, the British Intelligence Corps colonel with whom he had fought a battle of wits until December 1916, when Meinertzhagen was invalided. 3 years later, Lettow Vorbeck accepted an invitation to London, where he met face-to-face for the first time Jan Smuts. The two men formed a lasting friendship. When Smuts died in 1950, Lettow Vorbeck sent his widow a letter expressing his sympathy for her loss. A similar oft-quoted claim states that Lettow Vorbeck also apologized for the ungentlemanly death of the British hunter Frederick Selou at the hands of one of his snipers. This claim, however, is not supported by any contemporary evidence. Let me just jump around that a little bit. You may remember Meinertzhagen in the Battle of Tanga, and Meinertzhagen was busy observing things, and he was the only guy who was actually telling the truth when the British generals were lying about what was going on. And that there was a dinner, and the Germans and the British had a dinner after the battle, and they actually made good friends with Meinertshagen. And so clearly, all these years later, this has come back, and now that friendship has caused him to go to London. And there he met General Jan Smuts, the Boer general who'd commanded the British army against him. So it's quite interesting that Letar Vorbeck becomes friends even with Smuts. Smuts is pro-Jewish. Smuts is anti-Hitler. So that's quite interesting. All that story about Frederick Selous, it seems that's a junk story. So there's no apology for the death of Frederick Selous. Frederick Selous is an interesting person. Frederick Selous is a British hunter, and in the Rhodesian Bush War, the unit called the Selous Scouts is actually named after this guy. So I didn't know that Frederick Selous was actually killed in the British East Africa campaign. It actually explains how he died. It says, on 4 January 1917, Selous was fighting in the Bush War on the banks of the Rufiji River against German colonial Schutztruppen, which outnumbered his troops 5-1. That morning, he was creeping forward in combat during a minor engagement in which he raised his head and binoculars to locate the enemy. He was shot in the head by a German sniper and killed instantly. So that is how Frederick Selous died. And I can tell you that in Rhodesian history, Frederick Selous features big time. He is an important character in Rhodesian history, and that is where the Selous Scouts comes from. Let's continue. Political career. In a review of the work on von Letar Vorbeck, and it cites some German historians, they agree that Letar Vorbeck did not directly show susceptibility to far-right politics and anti-Semitism. And the one historian writes that Letar Vorbeck did not seek publicity out of opportunism or greed, and only morphed into a public figure because of the society at the time's desire for a reminder of bygone times. Between May 1928 and July 1930, Letar Vorbeck served as a Reichstag deputy for the monarchist German National People's Party. He left the party in 1930 after Alfred Hugenberg became the party leader and drew it increasingly into the far right. Letar Vorbeck then joined the Conservative People's Party and ran for it in the election of 1930, where he gained the best result of the party in his electoral district of Upper Bavaria, but was not re-elected. He intensely distrusted Hitler and his movement, and approached his relative, a guy by the name of von Blumenthal, and it basically turns out that he decided to form a coalition with another group against the Nazis. This resulted in the Vorbeck-Blumenthal Pact. So you see, Letar Vorbeck distrusts the Nazis, distrusts Hitler. He's obviously different because of his experiences in Africa, his friendships with the English and with Jan Smuts. He's a conservative. He's not into the new things that Hitler's trying to do, the new awesome things Hitler's trying to do. Let's just continue. Nazi Germany. Later, when Hitler offered him the ambassadorship to the court of St. James's in 1935, he declined. The suggestion for the nomination as ambassador to the court of St. James's had come from the retired colonel Meinertshagen during a visit to Berlin, his old friend Meinertshagen. During the 1960s, Charles Miller asked the nephew of a Schutztruppe officer, "I understand that von Letau told Hitler to go fuck himself." The nephew responded, except that I don't think he put it that politely. So they really make this thing out to be very negative. We don't know how bad it really was. Anyway, it continues. After his blunt refusal, Letta was kept under continual surveillance and his home office was searched. Thanks to his popularity among the German people, he was promoted to the rank of general for special purposes in 1938 at the age of 68, but was never recalled to active service. Okay, so that is the whole story of why he never fought in World War II. And Hitler liked him, and Hitler wanted to use him. And he could have done work for Hitler, but he refused to do work for Hitler. And he refused to have anything to do with the Nazis. I get the sense that he's conservative, and there's maybe a bit of a liberal side to him. Doesn't like the racial stuff of Hitler. So this is just to give you some background on what happened to him. But now we want to go and look at the stuff that gives us some real insight, another lesson from him. So it's very sad that Hitler could not get this man to work with him. But as you can see, it wasn't Hitler's fault. And the fact that he was already very friendly with Jan Smuts. Jan Smuts was a Zionist. Jan Smuts was pro-Jew. Jan Smuts did law for Jews. Jan Smuts played a big role in the creation of Israel. So if he and Jan Smuts got along, then that can only tell you that he's not open to the racial stuff that Hitler's saying. But even so, you're going to learn a lesson from von Letta Vorbeck, a very important lesson. It then continues with this. Here we get to critical area. By the end of the Second World War, Letta Vorbeck was destitute. His house in Bremen had been destroyed by Allied bombs, and he depended for a time on food packages from his friends Meinertz Hagen and Jan Smuts after the post-war economic boom. However, he enjoyed comfortable circumstances again. In 1953, he visited Dar es Salaam, where he was welcomed by surviving Askaris, who greeted him with their old marching song, Haya Safari, the song that you heard at the beginning of the video. British colonial officials welcomed him with full military honors. Now listen to this. As colonialism came to an end in Africa, several activists for the independence of Tanganyika, who were all the sons of Letta Vorbeck's Askaris, came to seek his advice. As there had been violence against the white population of the former colony of German East Africa, Letta Vorbeck later recalled that he gave one of them, who later became a government official in independent Tanzania, quotes, a good talking to. I told him not to despise the white people and not to humiliate them for the mistakes they made. Now listen to how the black guy replied to him. We only repudiate the small men, father, he replied, when the white man is big enough, as you were big enough. We continue to respect him. Letta Vorbeck was pleased by this answer and laughed and slapped his knee when he told Leonard Mosley about the conversation. Let's sit back and just talk about this a little bit. You remember that when they finally surrendered and he was leaving Africa, the blacks were so impressed with him, they called him Bwana. And the blacks were saying to him, we will follow you anywhere. And if this is not the right time, then our children will take our place and follow you. So Letta Vorbeck's leadership skills and his abilities massively impressed the blacks, massively impressed them, to the point where they don't even want to remain in their own country anymore. They will follow him to the ends of the earth. Now this is what happens when a man becomes a good leader. When a man becomes a good leader of men, then eventually you get this kind of thing. where men will say, we will follow you to the ends of the earth. Guys like Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, Napoleon, they had men who felt that way about them. And ditto for Hitler and ditto for various German generals, where their leadership skills are so great that men look up to them, even black men look up to them. And they are so impressed that it doesn't matter whether they even have to leave their country, they'll go with this guy. So adding to this is that when the blacks in Tanzania, former German East Africa, later want to gain independence, here are the sons of the Askaris who clearly had been told by their fathers about this awesome guy and that they must see him. And one of them goes and actually meets with Letao Vorbeck. And so Vorbeck says to him, because there's been killing of whites, he says to them, I told him not to despise the white people and not to humiliate them for the mistakes they made. And then the black guy replies, we only repudiate the small men, father, when the white man is big enough, as you were big enough, we continue to respect him. So let's just sit and talk about that for a second here. There are two things that are happening here. The one thing that Letao Vorbeck says, I agree with, but the other one is wrong. So he tells them not to despise the white people and not to humiliate them. I agree with that. But then the way he's worded it is he says not to humiliate them for the mistakes they made. That is wrong. But at least he did tell the black, don't despise them. And he's trying to stop the killing of whites. But listen to the black guy's answer. The black guy says, we only repudiate the small men. And then he uses the term father. Father means he's looking up to Letao Vorbeck. That's the same as Bwana, you know, where they're calling him sir. When the black says Bwana or the black says father, it means he's looking up to the guy. And so he's saying, we only repudiate the small men, father. So why is he saying that? And listen to the end. When the white man is big enough, as you were big enough, we continue to respect him. So what the hell is the black saying? The black is talking about the whites that they despise and humiliate and repudiate. And then the black says, but when the white man is big enough, as you were big enough, we continue to respect him. What the heck is going on here? Let me remind you, Nietzsche. What did Nietzsche say? Will to power. Nietzsche said, all humans and animals function on will to power, that all animals strive for power, and that includes humans. And here, out of the mouth of this black guy, he is saying that there are the small whites, and then there is a big white, and they will repudiate the small whites, but when the white man is big, then they respect him. They look up to him because of his leadership, because of his power, because of what he did. They are amazed by him as a sign of strength. They look up to him. They respect him because of his achievements, because of his strength, because of his ability. Their fathers saw what he could do. And so that's why they look up to him. And why are they calling the other whites small? They don't see anything in those whites that means strength. They don't see success in those whites. They, in their animal mode, like all humans have, in their animal mode, they are looking down on other white people. And they are feeling power, and they feel that they can take them on. But they know that they wouldn't dare to try that with him. Now, Letao Vorbeck is also a guy who's driven by his own thoughts and his own passions. So when the black said this to Letao Vorbeck, Letao Vorbeck was pleased with his answer and laughed and slapped his knee. This black is appealing to Letao's own vanity, for Letao wants to be looked up to, and if they look up to him, he's happy. And so for him, it's a fun answer because the black is telling him, you are a big white man. And he's not meaning physically, he's meaning in terms of character. You're a big white man in terms of character. We will always respect you. But those small white people, we repudiate them. We don't want anything to do with them. We want to be free of them. So these blacks will respect him and only him. And of course, his male ego is loving it. There's nothing wrong with that because a man also has an ego, and it's very important that a man has an ego. There's nothing wrong with that. But the issue here is, how are the blacks seeing him versus other whites? The blacks have got a respect for him. That respect comes from leadership. It comes from the things that he did with their fathers. And their fathers were amazed by this man, that this man could achieve all these things. He could fight the enemy. They were never defeated. They were never caught. And so their fathers look up to him. This is a big man. This is a man who can achieve. But these other whites, these are small whites, and we think we can do better than them. The blacks think like that. If you look at black history, you'll see that in black tribes, blacks only respect strength. When they have got a strong chief, they will love him and respect him. A chief who doesn't muck around, a chief who maybe flipping takes people, sentences them to death, has them beaten to death or sticks knocked up their rectums and tortures them to death. Blacks will respect their chief if he is strong. Among the blacks, strength is very important. They aren't worried about cruelty. What's important to them is strength, okay? They recognize strength. And I think it can be said that all lower humans go for strength and they're amazed by it. And whites have got a lot of natural strength that we don't even notice. And we even downplay it. And what we think is a moral thing to do by downplaying our strengths is actually bad. Because other races, especially a weak race like the blacks, they only understand strength. And strength amazes them, and strength is something that mesmerizes them. So, let us stop with von Lettow Vorbeck here, and let's move forward to another similar lesson. There is some thunder as I'm busy recording. Let's take a look at some lessons from Rhodesian history. And I'm going to jump around a bit and you'll see similar lessons to what came out of von Lettow Vorbeck's experience. The first thing that I want to tell you about is that in Rhodesian history is something that's like the Rhodesian version of the Alamo, where some white guys fought and they fought to the death. It's known as the Shangani Patrol, and it's actually from a war that took place in the 1890s. So we're not going to discuss the entire war. Instead, we're going to look at what happened to the Shangani Patrol, and more importantly, the reaction of the blacks. And this is not a full discussion about all of the fighting that was going on. This is just stuff from the war that the whites and the blacks were fighting. It was the whites against the Matabele. The Matabele were the most warlike tribe in Rhodesia, and they are actually linked to the Zulus in South Africa. The Matabele are actually Zulus that were chased out of South Africa, and they ended up in Rhodesia. That in and of itself is a very fascinating story. But now, these blacks are in conflict with the whites, and I'm not going to concern myself with the basis of the war. All that we want to focus on is the Shangani Patrol. Basically, 34 white guys were sent on a mission, and these white guys ended up being killed by the blacks. But these British guys fought to the death. And what is very fascinating is how the blacks reacted to this. I'm going to be reading from a paper that is 232 pages long. But I'm only going to be reading specific pages out of this paper. The paper is called The Warrior Heritage, A Study of Rhodesia, and it's written by a Captain Alphen. It was written in May 1980. And it says here, a thesis submitted to Rice University, Houston, Texas, in partial fulfillment of the requirements for the degree of Master of Arts. This paper was approved for public release. I'm going to be reading from the bottom of page 35. This has been about the fighting between the whites and the blacks, the Ndebele, who are offshoots of the Zulu tribe from South Africa, and the Shangani Patrol are now dead. So it says, finally, on 14 December, the column linked up with F.C. Salu, who was scouting for the relief party. The ordeal was over. F.C. Salu is the guy whom the Salu Scouts is named after, and it's the same guy who gets killed in German East Africa, the guy that I mentioned earlier. So Frederick Salu was involved in this racial conflict in Rhodesia. So let me continue reading. The ordeal was over. Men's minds sometimes work in strange ways. For while Forbes was retreating, the Ndebele regiments that were not pursuing Forbes were coming into Bulawayo to surrender. The disastrous battles of the Shangani and the Imbembezi, the loss of Bulawayo, the retreat, the fact that the column was pursuing the king, that is the king of the Ndebele, and the fight put up by Wilson had shattered Ndebele morale. Lobengula's death from smallpox on 22 or 23 December ended all resistance. By Christmas, the forces had been disbanded. Jameson re-established the BSACP and threw Matabele land open for prospecting, save literally for the shouting, the war was over. So basically, the war is over. The whites have completely defeated the Ndebele, and the whites are taking over Matabele land. It continues, what of Wilson and his 33 men? One wonders how they died, whether they sang at the end, and if their deaths had been wasted. Victorian sources all say that the Wilson group formed a defensive perimeter with the carcasses of their horses and fought to the bitter end. Finally, with ammunition spent, or almost so, they met the final charge of the enemy by standing and singing, God Save the Queen. For sources, these works either quote nothing or quote something along the line of, some native told someone, etc. Revisionists of history and debunkers of legends should have had a field day with Wilson. But if they do debunk Wilson and they are correct, then how did the war end so quickly? How did a mighty race, people who charged into the muzzles of machine guns while armed with only a rifle or assegai, an assegai is a spear, and a shield, decide that it was time to surrender? Burnham, Ingram, and Gooding, the last men back from the patrol, all agree that at dawn on the 4th, Wilson and his men spurred their way into the heart of the encamped Ndebele and got to the lager of the king. The lager was deserted and Wilson's men were fired upon. Wilson retreated, losing two horses, and made a stand in a clearing to check temporarily the pursuing Ndebele. Though initially successful, he lost five more horses dead and three men wounded. Wilson continued to withdraw, hoping to get back to the column. At that point, he sent Burnham back with a report on the situation and a request for help. Since Burnham had asked for company, Wilson sent Ingram, the other scout, and Borrow sent his man, Gooding. The last any white man saw of Wilson, he continued to retreat. Some men, doubling on horses, all straining to get to a place where they could hold off the Indibili until help arrived. In considering the fate of Wilson's Shangani patrol, the only sources existing are blacks who were interviewed as late as 40 years after the event. When reading them, one may think that the black is trying to make the white feel good by telling him a story of great courage. One should remember that between the death of Wilson and the death of the king, the vast majority of Indibili warriors surrendered. It is obvious that something drastic happened to make those men surrender. In all, accounts exist from Dawson who, in his trading and mission for Jameson in March 1894, talked to many natives and the following blacks, and he names a whole bunch of blacks. Then he continues, "Every black account speaks of bravery. The fight must have lasted a long time, for Ginyalicha, one of the blacks, says, the people who had died in the morning had already blown up by the time the battle was over." In other words, their bodies, their corpses, have begun to decompose. "None surrendered, all fought to the death and died without a whimper. As Malalo says," another black, "when ammunition was gone, they were assegaied, covering their eyes." So they were stabbed to death. And they covered their eyes when they were being killed. "All the natives said that the whites sang, but no song could be identified. Many blacks, including Ginyalicha and a whole bunch of other blacks, repeated the cheer, 'Hip, hip, hooray.' Could it be that the whites cheered when they hit a native or when an attack was broken up? Machasha," another black, "says, 'We were preparing to rush in again when all the whites that could stood up, took their hats off, and sang. We were so surprised that it took us some time to make up our minds what to do. It is probable that men facing their end over a long period of time will not remain silent. Whether the patrol prayed, cheered, sang, or whatever, it seems certain that they orally communicated defiance to the enemy. Likewise, it appears certain that the patrol had a hand in ending the war. It is recorded that Mjan, the chief Induna, or combat leader, told Rhodes upon the former's surrender, 'It was a great killing, but for me, speaking in the early morning with Kumalo, the king, I was sad.' 'Why?' said everyone. 'Because I was thinking that if it took so many to kill 34 whites, how many should I need to drive them back across the mountains?' Thoughts similar to this run through all the statements. The Indibili, as men, appreciated bravery in others. Mziki says he is glad that courage lives on in another race. Upon his surrender, Mjan was overheard telling some of his bachelor warriors, 'We were fighting men of men whose fathers were men of men before them. They fought and died together. Those who could not have saved themselves chose to remain and die with their brothers. Do not forget this. You did not think the white men were as brave as the Indibili, but now you must see they are men indeed to whom you are as but timid girls.'" So let me just reread that piece. The Indibili, as men, appreciated bravery in others. Mziki says he is glad that courage lives on in another race. Upon his surrender, Mjan was overheard telling some of his bachelor warriors, because in their culture, they aren't allowed to marry until they have become a warrior and killed someone. That's how the blacks, these warrior blacks, think. So he tells the bachelor warriors, "We were fighting men of men whose fathers were men of men before them. They fought and died together. Those who could have saved themselves chose to remain and die with their brothers. Do not forget this. You did not think the white men were as brave as the Ndebele, but now you must see that they are men indeed, to whom you are as but timid girls." So that Ndebele is utterly impressed that white men are men in a way that the blacks can understand. They can appreciate courage because they themselves know what fear and death is like. So they see it and they grasp what it really takes. And this black guy, John, he's kind of freaked out because he says, and I'm going back to that piece, where he's speaking to Cecil Rhodes. Cecil John Rhodes, the founder of Rhodesia. Because Cecil Rhodes was also involved in this war. Cecil Rhodes did a bunch of stuff in this. So he told Rhodes upon the former's surrender, "It was a great killing. But for me, speaking in the morning with Khumalo, the king, I was sad." "Why?" said everyone. "Because I was thinking that if it took so many to kill 34 whites, how many should I need to drive them back across the mountains?" So here he is saying, well, we managed to kill 34 whites, but these whites put up such an incredible fight that if all the whites fight like this, then good God, how many troops are we going to need? Because if everyone fights like this, we're going to need huge amounts of troops in order to try and get these whites back out of our territory and drive them across the mountains. He's horrified by how many of his own people are going to be killed if all the whites are fighting like this. Now we're going to jump forward to the 1970s, to the Rhodesian Bush War. And what I'm going to show you is a 5-minute video. This 5-minute video basically summarizes the first big Rhodesian external raid. This raid is into Portuguese Mozambique, and they're going to hit a place called Nyadzonia. It's actually a ground attack, and it's a stunningly successful ground attack. And in this film footage, you're going to hear Colonel Reed Daly of the Sulu Scouts talking about how he came up with this plan and why he thought this plan was going to work. And he was convinced it was going to be a big success. And the plan was a stunning success. However, in this bit of film footage, they also interview the blacks. They interview a guy called Tikere. Tikere was one of the commanders, and they also interview Mugabe, who later went on to become president of Zimbabwe for decades. So watch this 5-minute piece of film footage, because what we really want to delve into are the reactions of the blacks, the reactions of Tikere and the reaction of Mugabe. We want to take a close look at what those blacks say about what happened there. So here's the film footage.
"These are the mass graves of hundreds of men, women and children killed by the Rhodesian army in one morning. Their camp had first been identified by a Rhodesian reconnaissance flight.
On his way home, he saw a gap in the clouds. They came through it, and right below him, fortuitously, was the camp, which the navigator snapped quickly. They blew it up so they could actually count the heads, and there were 800 terrorist gooks, as we call them, formed up in a hollow square being addressed by their commander on the playground.
Over the next few weeks, the camp was kept under surveillance as its population grew to an estimated 5,000. In August 1976, Reed Daly decided it was time to strike. 70 Sulu scouts would cross the Mozambique border and drive into the Nyadzonia camp disguised as guerrillas. They'd kidnap the commanders and destroy the camp. Reed Daly asked General Walls for his approval.
We unrolled all the maps on his floor, and he whistled in his teeth, and he looked at me, and he said, "Hell of a risk, yeah." And I said, it'll work, because that's the last thing I'd expect.
At 8 in the morning, the force swirled into the camp. Their disguise was so effective that they were mobbed by a cheering crowd, but someone spotted that masked troops in the back of one truck were white.
So the column commander gave the word to fire. It was like a scythe going through a cornfield. They just went down like flies.
A lot of them lay there injured and screaming, okay. I remember one girl, she was also injured and she was crying. She came from my home area, and it touched me, and after that I didn't want to think about it. You know.
Our casualties were 4 lightly wounded, and they were over 1,000. The exact was 1,026.
Killed.
Now, in war, you work on, for one kill, there's always at least 2 wounded. So there were a couple of thousand others who should have been running around with what we call oil leaks, you know.
I have never forgotten the kind of sight I saw there. I think they must have emptied some tons of ammunition, judging by the shells that gathered that almost half an acre or more of a camp, empty shells. It was really a massacre.
It was a good hit, and it certainly put Zandler back a long, long way.
It was played up as the usual way of being a refugee camp by the people on that side and by the United Nations. But I do believe that it was a justifiable military target.
Hickman's view is accepted by one of Mugabe's top commanders.
So you don't have a complaint about the principle of Nyidzonya being attacked?
No. No, no. As a soldier. Now you're talking to me as a soldier. Ah, yes. No. All I can say, like I was saying to General Rose, I said, how did you manage to knock us so flat? It really knocked us way too hurts, militarily.
Nyidzonya was followed by ferocious assaults on other guerrilla bases. They tested the resilience of Mugabe's forces to the limit.
You get so aggrieved, and it works on you and works on your emotion in such a way that you can never forgive perpetrators of action of this nature.
Mugabe reacted. Said, I'm beginning to wonder whether this armed struggle is worth pursuing. That's what he said to my face. When I expected such things to make someone more resolute, I felt very bad.
Let's go back and listen to Edgar Tekere. Edgar Tekere, where they ask him, does he have a problem with Nyidzonya? Because these blacks also lied about their camps. They lied about it and they claimed that these were just refugee camps, that the Rhodesian army had just attacked refugee camps. But after the war, in this interview with Tekere, he basically admits and he says, as a soldier, I don't have a problem with it. And he says that he said to General Walls, the commander of the Rhodesian army, he said to General Walls, how did you guys manage to do that? Because you knocked us flat. You knocked us where it really hurts. So there you can see, out of the mouth of a black who was in the military, and he's stunned by what the whites did. And after the war, he admits, how did you guys manage to do this? Because you knocked us flat, you knocked us where it hurts. Here's the bit of video footage again.
Hickman's view is accepted by one of Mugabe's top commanders. So you don't have a complaint about the principle of Nyidzonya being attacked?
No. As a soldier. Now you're talking to me as a soldier. Ah, yes. All I can say, like I was saying to General Rose, I said, how did you manage to knock us so flat? It really knocked us where it hurts, militarily.
In the next little clip, you'll actually hear Mugabe again, and you'll hear Mugabe's reaction. Mugabe takes the moralistic viewpoint, and he says, it was such a dreadful thing that was perpetrated by these whites. But he's functioning from a political viewpoint. However, notice Tekere, the soldier, notice Tekere's description of how Mugabe really reacted. Where Mugabe was saying he's wondering if this armed struggle, this war, is really worth pursuing. And he's actually shocked at how this knocks the wind out of Mugabe, where he actually expected much stronger leadership from Mugabe. So here's the bit of film footage.
You get so aggrieved, and it works on you and works on your emotion in such a way that you can never forgive perpetrators or action of this nature.
Mugabe reacted. He said, I'm beginning to wonder whether this armed struggle is worth pursuing. That's what he said to my face. When I expected such things to make someone more resolute, I felt very bad.
Now we're going to jump to the end of the Rhodesian-Bush War. So this is just a couple of years later, and now the war is being wound up, and Britain and America are now trying to come up with some kind of peaceful solution, and now all the sides have to negotiate. But now you're going to hear something from a Rhodesian Air Force guy who's involved in the negotiations and who's dealing with all these senior blacks, and he makes a very surprising discovery. I'm going to be reading various excerpts from a book called Winds of Destruction. Winds of Destruction is a very recent book about the Rhodesian Air Force. This book is unquestionably the best book ever written about the Rhodesian Air Force. And it's written by a guy called Peter Bauer. It's a double-barreled surname. His initials are PJH, and his surname is Peter, P-E-T-T-E-R, Bauer. This guy played a big role in the development of the Rhodesian Air Force. And he was there from before the war, during the war. He was involved in everything. And Peter Bauer has got an incredible story to tell. This book was written about 11 years ago. It is unquestionably the best book ever written about the Rhodesian Air Force. And Peter Bauer had a pretty high rank in the Air Force, and he was very involved as a pilot, and he played many roles. He's a very, very fascinating man. I just want to read a little bit about a weapon that I've mentioned before. When I did the video about white men losing wars, white men losing wars in Vietnam, etc., I mentioned a weapon called a flechette. And a flechette is nothing more than taking nails, normal nails that you nail into wood. And you put lots and lots of nails into a bomb or a rocket, for example, and you fire that or explode that so that these nails go out and they hit people. Peter Bauer experimented with many weapons, and we're going to be looking at his weapons as well later, but not in this video. But what I want to just read to you is something that he discovered. He'd experimented with flechettes. And he'd heard about their effectiveness in Vietnam, and he decided to implement them in Rhodesia. And so he was responsible for testing and getting this weapon going. but they didn't want to use this weapon outside of Rhodesia. However, by accident, it was used outside Rhodesia once. Otherwise, this weapon was used inside Rhodesia against blacks. But the key thing here that I want you to take note of is how did the blacks perceive the weapon? Because what we're looking at here is how do the blacks see things? So let me read here. Back in Com Ops, I was perplexed to learn that flechettes had been dropped in Mozambique, something we were not supposed to do by our self-imposed ruling. However, because Ginger Baldwin, a pilot, had set out for an internal target with flechettes, and because AHQ imposed no restriction for the external scene, he did not hesitate to use them. Although this happened to be a genuine mistake, it resulted in Rhodesia's single most devastating air action against Zandla, Zandla being one of the black armies. But I only learned this after the war had ended. From Zandla's top brass, I learned that they feared the, quotes, racist South African nail bombs more than the other South African weapons. They were, in fact, talking about flechette, alpha, golf, and mini-golf systems. Since we had not used flechettes externally, other than one pair of dispensers dropped at Tembui and the pair delivered by Ginger Baldwin, I thought Zandla was talking about flechette successes inside Rhodesia. No, they said, these are the blacks. No, they said, we know about some comrades nailed, nailed, literally, right? Nailed inside Zimbabwe, but it was the death of our 26 top commanders at review that made us fear these weapons the most. The whole situation came about because of Zandla's growing concern over Fumo Revanu auxiliaries. Let me just pause there. Fumo Revanu is yet another black militia created by whites. Okay, it's another bunch of blacks that the whites armed and used against the blacks. They are a small feature of this war. But now the blacks are running into problems because there are other blacks that are paid by the Rhodesians and armed by the Rhodesians also fighting them. So that's what Fumo Revanu is about. But anyway, the whole situation came about because of Zandla's growing concern over the Fumo Revanu auxiliaries, who had become a serious hindrance to their operations in most sectors. Josiah Tongongara, a senior black commander, decided there was only one way to find out exactly what was happening. He sent 26 senior commanders to Rhodesia to investigate the matter and return with detailed reports and recommendations, but none of them even made it into the country. As the TF call sign had said, Mozambican villagers were feeding these commanders preparatory to their night entry into the Burma Valley. Once through this valley, they intended to disperse to undertake independent analyses of the widespread auxiliary, that's Fumo Revanu, threat. They did not count on Ginger Baldwin's 9,000 flechettes, which eliminated every one of their numbers, together with the unfortunate Mozambican women who were feeding them. The description given of this strike intrigued me. The body of the leader bore 26 flechette wounds, and the least number of hits seen on any commander's body was 6. What shook the Zandla HQ team investigating this incident was the fact that every single feeding pot and plate had been holed by not less than one dart. If only we had known about this success 6 months earlier, we might have used flechettes externally, but not a single Frelimo radio intercept exposed Zanla's grievous loss. So basically what happens here is this is just one of the weapons that this guy has invented. All these other weapons, alpha bombs, golf bombs, mini golf bombs, those are other weapons that have been invented by Rhodesians. And almost all of these weapons were invented by this guy. And they've been using these things and they're killing blacks left, right and center. But the weapon that really gives the blacks the absolute creeps was the time when these flechettes were accidentally used and the pilot didn't know it, but he wasn't just killing normal blacks. He actually fired it into a place where he killed 26 top commanders of Zandler. And when the blacks came and inspected their dead, they found all of them penetrated by all these darts, each one hit by at least six or more. And they couldn't believe there were so many of these darts that not a single plate, not a single pot was unscathed. When these darts came, they just tore these commanders and the women and the pots and the pans, just tore it all to shit, and everyone was fucking dead. And these blacks were absolutely horrified by this. They'd never seen anything like this. So that is why these blacks say that they feared what they thought. They thought these things were racist South African nail bombs. And then they said, no, we know about some comrades nailed, and that's literally a play on words, inside Zimbabwe, but it was the death of our 26 top commanders at review that made us fear these weapons most. So this total little miniature massacre that just happened as a result of this one pilot firing these weapons at one target inside Mozambique gave these blacks the absolute creeps. And Peter Bauer laments the fact that they in the Air Force and in the Army, that nobody actually discovered how successful that particular attack had been and that it had freaked the blacks out. They only found out after the war. I was reading that piece and I will explain where that comes from because it's not quite in chronological order in his book. So he mentions that earlier in his book, but you may wonder how it is that at that point that he's mentioning discussions with senior black commanders of the enemy. Well, during the war, there were no discussions with senior black commanders because the two sides are at war with each other. But after the war, what happened was when the British and the South Africans organized the final peace talks between the blacks and the whites. They then had to bring together all the various leaders, the various political leaders, but also the various military leaders. And what happened was that Peter Bauer was one of the senior officers who was meeting with these black senior leaders. So now they are meeting and they are starting to talk to each other and getting to know each other as part of the negotiations. So they start meeting face to face. And he even invites some of them to dinner at his house, mainly because he doesn't have a budget. He can't take them to a hotel because there isn't a budget. So he invites them to his home. And then in between these personal meetings and other meetings in between negotiations, he starts to realize some things about the blacks. And now some very surprising things start coming out of the mouths of our enemies. Remember, there are two armies that the whites have been fighting. The whites have fought Zanla and Zipra. So now these Zanla and Zipra commanders are talking to the Rhodesian commanders. They're talking to the Rhodesian army. And Peter Bauer happens to be one of the few Air Force officers who is involved with these blacks. And he starts discovering a strange thing. So now that they are able to talk to each other face to face, they begin to ask each other questions and give each other opinions. The whites ask the blacks questions about things that the whites did to them during the war, and the blacks also ask questions and give answers. And what comes out of this is quite bizarre. So I'm going to start reading from a place where he's talking to a black guy who was in Zambia when the Rhodesian military launched an attack on a location that is referred to in here as NSO, but it's basically one of the black departments called National Security and Order. But basically it's an attack on one of the units or headquarters units of the blacks. So here goes. Dumiso, that's one of the blacks. Dumiso carried on with the subject of Nkomo's house attack to tell how Joshua, this is Joshua Nkomo, the leader of Zipra, and his wife left home in a hurry for Kaunda's palace. Kaunda is the president of Zambia. Immediately upon receiving a late night warning of the impending attack. Whilst on the subject, I asked him about the NSO attack. Dumiso confirmed that he and other senior men had kept well clear of the NSO for fear of a Rhodesian attack, which he thought would only take place at night. He had taken up nighttime residence with a girlfriend and returned daily to the NSO no later than 6 a.m. in the morning. On the day of the attack, he intended to do the same, but his girlfriend said she had dreamed of jets attacking at dawn. She insisted he remain at home for at least 2 hours to relax with a cup of coffee and listen to the radio. Dumiso obliged. As it happened, hunters, Hawker hunters, attacked FC camp at dawn, but Dumiso did not know this at the time. The first he knew of any hostile activity was when he heard explosions and firing at NSO. He claimed that this was not the only occasion that dreams had saved him from Rhodesian security force attacks. I asked Dumiso and Lookout. Lookout is another black's name. Now listen very carefully to this conversation. I asked Dumiso and Lookout. Lookout is another black. Why, when difficult issues were raised during ceasefire meetings, they and the ZANLA commanders always addressed me? In other words, there's a whole bunch of other white military officers there. But the blacks turned to Peter Bauer. So listen to this. The answer was surprising. They said Zipra's reason for doing this was identical to Zanla's reason. In other words, both black armies turn and face him and they ask him. And it continues, both insisted that the Air Force was superior to the Army. They considered themselves to be on an equal footing with the Army because they used similar equipment and fought on their feet. The Air Force was quite different. In their minds, it was this complex, high-tech force that had been responsible for the devastation visited upon their own forces. Because of this, I was held in highest esteem at the ceasefire committee meetings. Breaking away from the after-dinner chat for a moment, Rex Nongo, let me pause there. Rex Nongo is probably the best and most highly regarded of all the black military commanders of all the black armies that Rhodesia fights against. Rex Nongo is the best of the blacks, okay? So listen to this. Breaking away from the after-dinner chat for a moment, Rex Nongo had much the same to tell me later. But when I challenged him on the issue and said that the RLI had knocked the hell out of his forces, he asked, when did that happen without Air Force direct support and firepower? I tried again. What about the SAS, Special Air Services? They knocked the socks off you guys. Yes, he said, but they are Air Force troops. I told him he was wrong. Rex, SAS are Army troops. His reply was typical. Comrade Group Captain PB, the war is over, so you do not have to lie to me anymore. You know, and I know, that the SAS are Air Force troops. They live over the runway from Air Force. They are always with Air Force. They wear wings and blue belts. Their badge has a helicopter rotor blade. In brackets, Petabawa writes, in the illustration it can be seen this is actually a dagger, but the black thinks it's a helicopter rotor blade. Let's continue. And just like the Air Force pilots, they only attacked my men, never civilians. Returning to the after-dinner chat, Dumiso and Lookout happily answered many questions, and I answered theirs. They confirmed Zipra's intention to launch an invasion, this is of Rhodesia, but this was stymied by the destruction of bridges during Operation Dice. Worse still, it removed any hope of joining up with the RSF, the Rhodesian Security Forces, to bring about the destruction of Zandla. So Zipra says that they were hoping to invade Rhodesia and that they actually wanted to team up with the whites to destroy the other blacks. But this story about the planned invasion of Rhodesia is one that we will revisit. Let's continue. They had a lot to say about the efficiency of Rhodesian-made air weapons and told me they had recently learned that I was the prime mover in developing them. Rather than being annoyed by this, they were deeply impressed, like Zandla. They had previously believed the weapons were South African products. So let me pause there. The blacks have discovered that a lot of these really, really nasty weapons that these helicopters and aircraft have been using against them, that these really nasty, horrible weapons that have been tearing their guys to pieces, and there are other weapons other than the flechettes, we'll get to them, that all these horrific weapons that were absolute killers of people, that this guy, Petabawa, was actually the prime mover who invented them, that the guy who had been responsible for tearing their people to shreds on a large scale, you would think that they would hate him, that they would hate him with intensity. Here is the prime murderer and killer of their people. And how do the blacks look on it? Petabawa says, they had a lot to say about the efficiency of Rhodesian-made air weapons and told me they had recently learned that I was the prime mover in developing them. Rather than being annoyed by this, they were deeply impressed because, like Zandla, they had previously believed the weapons were South African products. So they're amazed that this British guy invented these weapons that are tearing them apart. They thought these weapons were so advanced that they could only come from South Africa, but that actually this British guy has invented them, and this is the guy who's been slaughtering them. He's been playing with weapons that have killed thousands and thousands of their people, as you'll discover later when you see how effective these weapons were. Here's another piece where you can get the feeling that the blacks have respect for the whites. You would think that after fighting each other brutally, literally for 20 years, because the fighting already started in the early 1960s actually, you would think that after fighting each other for so long that the blacks wouldn't want anything to do with whites. But in actual fact, the blacks look up to the whites. So let me read this, because this relates to General Walls. General Walls is the commander of the Rhodesian forces. He's the overall commander of everything Rhodesian. The Air Force, the Army, the police, everything. So listen to this. For me, it was really quite incredible to learn that Josiah Tongogara, the man we took to be our radical arch enemy, was a man who really sought peace and stability. Recorded here are the points of agreement he made with Zipra, as I recall them. First was the matter of setting up a military triumvirate of the Rhodesian security forces, Zipra and Zandla, initially in London. So basically what it is now the two black armies and the Rhodesian forces are going to be joined together. But who is going to lead this new military force? Well, it continues, their joint task would be to bring into immediate effect a disconnection of forces. Tongogara had no difficulty in accepting that General Walls should head the triumvirate, whose headquarters would be established in Salisbury and separated from existing Rhodesian security force establishments. Zipra and Zandla would order all their forces to move into military camps on home soil at locations agreed by General Walls. So here are these blacks, and the whites are saying to them, okay, we've got to bring all our armies together, but we would think that General Walls should be in charge of everything. He should be at the top of all of this. And the blacks have no problem. They have no problem being subservient to someone they had fought against. You would think that they would be arguing and insisting that they be in charge of everything. And yet, even in victory, because everything's going to go to the blacks now, even in victory, because basically handing over to the blacks is victory for them. Even in victory, these blacks have no problem being commanded by a white man who fought them. War is a thing that causes men to resolve the issue of superiority. And when men have fought each other, even men who've been out there trying to kill each other actively, and this happens in many wars, ultimately skill and ability counts. And those who have fought and survived will openly acknowledge, in most cases, they'll openly acknowledge who is superior on the other side. And these blacks recognize quality, and they recognize someone who they tried to destroy, but who successfully hurt them and smashed them. And rather than being filled with extreme hatred, they have respect for someone who stood up to them. But let's just return to the black perception that the Rhodesian Air Force was superior to the army. The Rhodesian Air Force was tiny. The entire Air Force, including the admin staff on the ground, including the guys who were repairing the aircraft, etc., the entire Air Force was no more than 1,000 people. And all the pilots were white, and all the mechanics and technical people were white. The blacks were only there to sweep the hangars and do very basic stuff. But these blacks are so impressed with the firepower of the Rhodesian Air Force. They are so stunned by the firepower of the Rhodesian Air Force and what it does. And for them, anything that reeks of the Air Force is superior. So, for example, the SAS. The SAS is Special Air Services. It's the same as the South African Rakkies. And the SAS basically mostly go into action by jumping with parachutes. That's their original game plan. They are flown into territory, mostly outside the country, and they are dropped off there by air, and that's how they function. But because these blacks see them as being so related to the Air Force, the blacks look on the SAS and they say, no, SAS aren't army, they are air force. And they don't even believe the white guy when he tells them. No, the SAS is just normal army, actually. It's army, but, you know, with a air component. And these blacks are like, no, man, SAS is air force. And they don't care about the other units. They don't care about who attacks them. They notice that whenever they're getting clobbered, that the Air Force is involved in this. And it freaks them out, the damage that they're taking from the air. The air power is hurting them badly. And this firepower from the air completely amazes, impresses, and puts the fear of God into them. So let me just reread that little section, because it's a fantastic discussion. I asked Dumiso and Lookout why, when difficult issues were raised during ceasefire meetings, they and the ZANLA commanders always addressed me. Let me pause. You see, they look up to this guy. They've got all these other white officers, probably others of even higher rank than this guy. But when they have to address the whites, they're not even worried about the rank structure of the whites, where the whites say this guy's higher rank than that guy. Peter Bauer is not the highest ranking white guy there. And yet, when the blacks have to address the whites, they address the white that they look up to, and they look up to him because he's Air Force. So they don't even care about all these other army guys and what rank they are, these other white guys. They don't care who's been assigned to being the top guy that they must talk to. They naturally look to the Air Force guy because to them, Air Force is superior. So let me read it. When I asked Dumiso and Lookout why, when difficult issues were raised during ceasefire meetings, they and the ZANLA commanders always addressed me. The answer was surprising. They said Zipro's reason for doing this was identical to ZANLA's. Both insisted that the Air Force was superior to the Army. They considered themselves to be on an equal footing with the Army, because they used similar equipment and fought on their feet. So let me pause there. They see these other white guys who are doing things that are the same as them, and they regard them as being more or less equal to them. But then there are these guys who function in the air, and for them, this is magic, the death from the air. And it continues, the Air Force was quite different. In their minds, it was this complex, high-tech force that had been responsible for the devastation visited upon their own forces. Because of this, I was held in highest esteem at the ceasefire committee meetings. So here is the guy who represents the part of the Rhodesian security forces that slaughtered them the most. And you'd think that they don't want to speak to him, that they hate him, that they'd like to slit his throat the first chance that they get. But no, no. The guy who killed and hurt them the most is the guy they respect the most. Breaking away from the after-dinner chat for a moment, Rex Nongo, the best black leader in all the black armies, had much the same to tell me later. But when I challenged him on the issue and said the RLI, Rhodesian Light Infantry, had knocked the hell out of his forces, he asked, when did that happen without Air Force direct support and firepower? So he's not even worried. Oh, well, we were beaten by the RLI. But you know what? We were only beaten by the RLI when the Air Force was busy smacking the shit out of us. I tried again. What about the SAS? They knocked the socks off you guys. Yes, he said, but they are Air Force troops. I told him he was wrong. Rex, SAS or Army troops? His reply was typical. Comrade Group Captain PB, the war is over, so you do not have to lie to me anymore. You know and I know that SAS are Air Force troops. They live over the runway from the Air Force. They're always with the Air Force. They wear wings and blue belts. Their badge has a helicopter blade. Actually, it's a dagger. And just like the Air Force pilots, they only attacked my men, never civilians. And then on top of it all, they're even more impressed when they discover that PB is the guy who invented the freaking weapons that has been slaughtering them. That this is the guy who was the brains behind all the slaughter. And they're freaking impressed. It says they had a lot to say about the efficiency of Rhodesian-made air weapons and told me that they had recently learned that I was the prime mover in developing them. Rather than being annoyed by this, they were deeply impressed because, like Zanla, they had previously believed the weapons were South African products. So all these horrible little bombs that Peter Bauer has been inventing and testing and perfecting over the years that just fucking slaughter these blacks, okay? They discover, here's the guy who invented all the stuff that killed our people, ripped our people to pieces, brought us the greatest freaking pain we've ever known, and whoa, this guy impresses us. Why? Because Peter Bauer represents power. He kills. He's a killer. He comes from the Air Force, which is a killing machine, and he himself is a prime killer of them. He's the greatest mass murderer from the white side. He is responsible for more blacks dying, being torn to shreds, maybe some of them totally buggered up for life. Those who manage to live might be cripples for life. And these blacks are impressed as hell that the prime murderer, the prime killer, the representative of the nastiest killing machine, and it's got these magical high-tech ways of ripping their people to pieces. And they're like, whoa, this guy, here's a white man. Here is a white man we can look up to. Nature only understands power. And these blacks are impressed with power and death and slaughter. They can't slaughter like the Air Force. They can't slaughter like this man. They are blown away that this is the prime killer from the white man's side. It impresses the hell out of them. And they look up to him. They look up to him and they are so amazed. They have respect for the greatest white murderer and slaughterer of the lot. The final piece of film footage that I want to show you may actually surprise you. It's modern and it's a bunch of whites who are dancing, and they're dancing in China. This is from a show known as River Dance, and they're doing some great dancing from the British Isles, and they're dancing in China in a big hall. But watch the reaction of the Chinese to these whites. These are mostly white women. Watch how this show ends. This piece of film footage is 6 minutes long. Watch how this whole thing ends as it picks up tempo and gets more and more intense. And watch these Chinese. How do these Chinese react to this show? Look at the expressions on their faces and how impressed they are. They're totally blown away by these whites. Okay, so let's summarize and look at what came out of all of those things that I showed you. If we go back to von Lettow Vorbeck, we can see that the blacks are impressed by him and they listen to him and they take him seriously. But other whites who haven't shown that kind of leadership and that kind of ability, the blacks look down on them. If we look at the Shangani Patrol and what happened to them, there we have the amazing fact that a small group of whites who fight like absolute lunatics to the death, that there are even blacks who start surrendering and quitting when they realize how tough the whites are. And even those who don't just surrender outright, they walk away with the view, good God, if it takes so much effort to kill so few whites, then how the hell are we going to chase all the whites out of the country? And these blacks tell other blacks, those guys, those are real men, and their fathers before them were real men. And you're like a girl. You're like a girl compared to those white guys. So it doesn't matter whether you are fighting against blacks or whether blacks are on your side, like in the case of von Lettow Vorbeck. At the end of the day, these blacks look at what you can do. And if they see excellence, even if they defeat you, if they see excellence and they get a chance to think about it, they are stunned by it and they're impressed by it. If we go to Nyadzonia, we can see that Edgar Tekere, and by the way, I think much later towards the end, I think Mugabe even had Edgar Tekere murdered. But you could see there that Edgar Tekere was shocked by what the whites did. And when he had a chance to talk to General Walls after the war, he said to him, how did you guys do that? How did you manage to knock us like that? You know, we never saw that coming. Of course, at the time, they took a lot of pain and they weren't that happy about it. The only black who's filled with hatred is the politician, Mugabe. He's hateful. But all the other blacks who are involved in combat, all the blacks that are involved in actual fighting, they turn around and they say, whoa, these white men can really fight. And it blows their minds. And they look at them with respect. The guys who clobber them and show them that they can fight, these blacks look at them with total respect. And then there was Peter Bauer, the Air Force guy, and the blacks were so insanely impressed with him because this guy gets down to the business of killing and he's part of the Air Force and he even invented the weapons that went on to kill thousands of blacks. And they are just so stunned by this guy. Notice how the blacks look up to Peter Bauer with the same deep respect that they have for von Lettow Vorbeck. The blacks who are negotiating with the Rhodesians, they turn to Peter Bauer. Instead of turning to our leaders that are there, they specifically turn to Peter Bauer. By the blacks' measure, Peter Bauer should be the leader of the whites. They look up to him in awe. The blacks understand when a man is a man, and the blacks who fight gain respect when they see they're up against white men who not only can match them but are far better than them. They're amazed when these white men fight them and kick their asses. Even if hundreds or thousands of their people are dead, they are just so amazed. And like Edgar Tekere says, when he talks about speaking to General Walls, he says, how did you guys do that? He's stunned by it. And he speaks and he says, as a soldier, in other words, soldier to soldier, now that he's up against someone who's fought him on his level and who's kicked his ass, he now has real respect for that guy. And how does this compare with that image that I had of the white policeman in America kneeling? I'll bet you that that doesn't buy whites much. But what buys them a lot more is when you can show them that you are superior. The only people who will scream and whine and cry and do everything they can to get you away from showing your power and your superiority are Jews and liberals. Jews Tories and liberals are the only ones that don't want whites to show their power. But when the blacks see the superiority of the white man and what the white man is capable of, the blacks are just amazed by it. Even if they ended up killing you, even if they won, they begin to realize that, hey, these white guys, they mean business, and they'll belt you, and they'll hurt you, man. They'll freaking kill you. So for the blacks, when the blacks saw Peter Bauer of the Air Force, they looked up to this white man. He's the greatest mass killer among the whites. He's in the Air Force, and he invents the weapons that slaughter the blacks. The weapons he invents go on to kill thousands and thousands of blacks, and they're nasty weapons. And the blacks were like so amazed. This is the white man they look up to. They look at the white man who's the greatest killer of them. When they see power, whether they are on your side, like in the case of von Lettow Vorbeck, or whether they're against you, when they see power and excellence, they are in awe. And even if they manage to kill you, the fact is they know what it took to kill you, and they know that if they were in the same situation, that they would never put up a fight like the Shangani Patrol, for example. And what about those white dancers from that river dance show? Those Chinese were impressed by excellence. They didn't sit there crying and whining that the white men and women are this or that. At the end of the day, all they care about is quality and excellence, and they're absolutely blown away by these whites and their dancing and their excellence at what they do. So you see, it's only Jews and liberals who don't want whites to be themselves to the maximum that they can be. It is the enemy within that doesn't want us to go out there and to really win. If we go anywhere and we face anybody and we take them on and we are better than them, and we are not just a little bit better, we are a huge, massive, overwhelming amount better, other races will look on us in awe. When other races see us not just winning, but winning big, fighting hard, showing toughness, showing mental ability, the ability to work out plans, to defeat them, to break them, to smash them. If they see what we can do, and then they know what they can do, and they know, oh man, we could never be as good as those whites. We could never be as excellent as that. If we had to fight this hard, many of our guys would run away, or we'd quit, or we'd don't know how the hell those whites beat us, but they freaking beat us. What the hell did those whites do that caused us to lose so badly? When they realize raw excellence, when they compete against us, they're amazed by it. They don't go like these Jews and liberals running around doing the guilt trip. They are genuinely impressed. They are not only genuinely impressed, they genuinely look up to us, and they say, whoa, this is unbelievable. How did so few whites do that? How did they manage to do this and do that? We would never have been able to do that. In the case of Peter Bauer, the fact that he's a pilot and that he's part of the Air Force, the blacks are just amazed by this little killing machine that comes out of the sky. And they've got respect for that thing, because when that thing comes, it's going to hurt them, man. And you can go and look anywhere in the world, and you'll see that all humans will respect us if we are strong enough. If we are strong enough, they'll respect us. The only group of people who don't do that are the Jews. And the Jews are in and amongst us, and the Jews are telling us the complete opposite. And the Jews are saying, oh no, you mustn't do this. You must be softer and kinder. No, other races, even the dumbest other races, do have a grasp of excellence. It's only Jews and demented liberals Negroes who are telling whites to not give their all. If whites go and we go in there to win and we give it our everything, even if we lose, other races will have respect for us. Courage and ability is something that others can understand, especially when they are fighting you and they realize that you have more courage than them and you got more ability than them. And they know, oh man, we got to be careful of these people. These people can kill us all. Or even if we win against these people can cause us so much pain that we'll just have piles and piles and piles of dead. Do we really want this thing so badly that we'll fight these whites and we may end up with piles and piles of dead on our side? And then they'll say, you know what? We got to be nice to these people because these people can hurt us, and let's rather be nice to them. Maybe we can learn from them. It is only Jews and liberals, they're the only garbage on the planet, that will undermine whites when whites do well. The Jewish filth don't want whites to win at all, never mind winning big. But when we give it our everything and we do our utmost, others will see it. And then they'll start calling you Bwana and Father because they know that you are superior to them. When the others realize our superiority and our excellence, they will accept reality. They haven't got a choice. If we are excellent, they will have no choice but to accept reality. And they will be forced, whether they like it or not, to look up to us. Jewry is the only thing that is so arrogant that they will attack whites, go after whites, run whites down, regardless of our excellence. These people are lunatics, but other races, regardless of their low IQ or any other faults that they may have, other races are stunned by sheer excellence. It doesn't matter whether you live or you die. What matters is that you've put up the best fight that you could. Even these blacks in the 1890s, notice that these blacks never at any time have a problem over the issue of race. They can see we are different. They know we are different to them. They don't sit and argue about that point. And if in their experience they see that we are excellent and awesome and that we can meet them in any way and beat them, even in war, in the ultimate competition, they will be forced to accept that we're awesome. But the most important thing is, the time that they really respect you is when they can see what we can do in the real world. That it's not just us sitting and mouthing off. That when it gets down to being dirty and determined, that we can be more than a match for them. Then they see superiority, and then they respect you. They respect you in a serious, meaningful way. Not just in some kind of wishy-washy, light way. Oh, you're a good person. I like you because you're good. No. In the way in which you look up to someone and they say, Father, or they turn to Peter Bauer. All of them turn and look at Peter Bauer to ask this white man, what is his view? That alone should show you that if they are ignoring all the other military officers that are sitting there and they turn to Peter Bauer, that should show you, man, straight out there, that he's the only guy they look up to. He's the white man that they look up to the most. In their eyes, he's the best of the whites, and they can grasp it and they can understand it. And the same with those Chinese. The Chinese are just looking at excellence and they can grasp it and they can see it. And did you see how they applauded? They were absolutely blown away by these whites. And these whites didn't go there to go and talk to them and please will you like me and this and that and I'm kneeling next to you. They just went out and they did their best at what they do. And those Chinese were stunned by that. We as a race have no need to be afraid of anyone or anything, as long as we're determined to stand our ground. If we stand our ground, we will quickly be respected. We'll be respected in a big way. And here in Africa, I've watched the blacks a lot, and I can tell you that there are blacks, even now, there are some blacks, even now, who know that whites are better. It is only Jews and liberals and communists who've come along and said, oh no, we're all equal. No, no, no. Being equal isn't going to solve the problem. The other races will accept you if they can see clearly that you are superior. And if you are superior, they will treat you with more respect than you've ever had in your life. Nobody will have to tell them to respect you. They will respect you because they know what you can do. And if we as a race stand together and we stand firm and we ensure that at all times we show our determination and our excellence and we stop being weaklings, you will see the many things that will come from that. Once they respect you, and part of that can also be fear, but once they know that you're serious, you get stuff done, you can't be toyed with, then you'll see them behaving themselves. They won't be doing like that BLM woman who turns around and says that whites are subhuman defects. If they really respect you, they will treat you completely differently. And it's not about, oh, come, let's shake hands, let's go out for a drink. That's not going to buy you respect. Respect is something that you're going to get if you beat them, either at warfare or at some other important contest. If you can show them that you can kick their asses, then they'll respect you. And when they respect you, they'll watch their mouths. They'll watch their P's and Q's. And in the future, all that any white person will have to do is a white person will just have to turn around and say to them, hey, don't do that. Or even just frown at something or show some kind of displeasure in even the slightest way. And other races will get the message immediately. When I look at the Jews, I'm absolutely convinced that whites have been too nice to Jews for too long, and Jews are allowed to get away with all kinds of hogwash, and that because we leave them to play their dirty games, they lose respect for us. We would actually not have any racial problems with any race at all, including the Jews, if we were stronger and we showed that we meant business. But look at the blacks. In the case of the Rhodesians, in order to get real respect out of the blacks, we had to kill them. We had to kill large numbers of them. And then the blacks had respect for the whites. I can tell you that these other races will accept our superiority without a problem, as long as they perceive it's real. Our biggest issue is the enemy within. Jewry sitting in and amongst us, knifing us in the back, and telling us to do things that are going to make us look weak. It hasn't got anything to do with right and wrong. It's got to do with strength versus weakness. Other races will respect us when they see we are strong. When you are very strong, not much else matters. But if they see you are weak and they sense weakness, then they'll begin to mess with you and play with you and toy with you and start screwing you around. And it doesn't matter, like in the case of that American policeman kneeling. I can tell you, those kinds of things mean very little. And other races will see it for what it is. They'll see the kneeling and they'll say, why is the white man kneeling? Why is the white man talking so sweetly? It must be because he's weak. These things are very important to know, because to sit and debate with the blacks and with everyone else, are we equal? Are we superior? All of that stuff is a waste of time. When you show that you are superior, not just a little bit superior, but but amazingly superior, in a way that leaves them in awe. They will have no choice but to accept that. And they may even prefer to be ruled by someone who is superior. When they see that you are excellent and that all the things that you do are good and awesome, they won't turn on you so easily, and they'll actually prefer being ruled by you than by someone else who is weaker than you. I cannot impress enough the importance of strength. We should never ever hold back on anything. If they want to argue with us, if they want to fight us, if they want to compete with us, we mustn't make anything easy. We must go out and win big to the maximum that is humanly possible. All this other rubbish is not good for us. And if we as a race all act in a firm, strong way, it'll make it easier for everyone. It'll make it easier for all of us. If, for example, Hitler had won the Second World War and had been strong and able to continue doing his thing, that would have made everything easier for all whites. But when you've got whites who start acting weak, then these other races lose respect for us. And if they start seeing that they can come up with some bullshit, and even they know it's bullshit, and they see, we can fool these whites with bullshit like the Jews do all the time, then they are going to quickly lose respect for us. And if they stuff us around and they do crooked things and they get away with it, we should punish them. And again, you'll see jury is constantly working on weakening the law. Our biggest problem are these Jews who are working amongst us, undermining us. And it's only because we are weak in the way that we deal with these people. All of our problems actually come from weakness. You could say that we as a race need to act like men. That when our race acts like a boss, like a manly man, and we turn around and we make the rules, and we tell other people, no, you can't do that, shut up over there, we don't accept this, etc. If we act like a boss, and we can back it up with physical and mental excellence, you'll see that we can solve many problems really fast. Take, for example, all this equality nonsense. All these issues about equality, these things come from us exhibiting weakness, from us stepping backwards. And the moment that you show weakness, other races will see through it in a second. They will immediately say, look at these whites, they're different today. They used to behave like that, but look at them behaving like this. They are weaker. They will spot it in 2 seconds. And once they see that you are exhibiting weakness, they will naturally start exploiting it. They will naturally try to see what can they get out of us in our weakened state. And from there onwards, this thing just snowballs. Now you got blacks who think that they built the pyramids and they did all kinds of fancy stuff. But the most important thing is that weakness leads to the natural fact that they will seek power. If they see weakness, then they'll start saying, maybe we can beat these people. All we've got to do is work in this way and that way. We might be able to beat these whites. Weakness leads to huge problems. There is another topic that's related to this that I want to touch on, but I want to do it in a separate video because it comes from another white guy, a guy who had some really unique experiences, and it's got to do with the death penalty. All of this softness in terms of punishment is wrong. We need to punish people properly. Anything that smells of weakness is bad for us. It's bad for our civilization. It's not natural for us. If you go and you look at our ancestors, they were always firm. We made laws that were necessary and we did what we needed to do. We didn't do any of this pussyfooting around. In ancient times, we even tortured people, and executing people for certain kinds of crimes was always the norm. All of those things are very good and they are absolutely necessary. The humans that we allow to play around with us the most are the Jews. And that stuff is all bad, all of it, because they get to know us, they get to see which tricks work against us, in what ways can they weaken us. They spot all these ugly things and they use those things. That is where our big problems come from. From too much familiarity, not being firm, not punishing people, not sorting out groups of people and putting them in their place. And out of all of this come the very problems that are now a nightmare across all of Western civilization. If we were strong and we were determined, we would put so many of these things to bed so quickly. Our natural excellence works for us totally. We don't have to debate excellence. We just have to be excellence. We just show them what we can do, and we must never be afraid to compete with them in any way. And when we compete with them, we must go all out to win. So forget everything that you ever heard from Jews and liberals. It's all rubbish. It's all a bunch of junk. You can have true respect, but you'll only get it when you are excellent and strong. And in nature, all humans, all animals understand strength. I just want to talk about something else related to Rhodesia, which actually runs counter to some of this Rhodesian Air Force stuff. It was said for a very, very long time, and people quoted it in books, and I believed it. It was said for a very long time that the Selous Scouts were the guys who killed the most terrorists in the Rhodesian War. It was said that 70% of all the blacks who were killed by the Selous Scouts. However, when I went through that book, Winds of Destruction, and I also spoke to a Rhodesian author called Chris Cox. Several years ago, I spoke to Chris Cox. He's the author of a good book called Fire Force. It's a first-hand account of a guy who was involved in the most intensive daily fighting that the young guys could have had in Rhodesia. And my brother spent one day on Fire Force. He was quite a bit older by that time. He was in his 30s, whereas these guys were much younger. They were like 18, 19. My brother spent one day doing Fire Force, and my brother said to me afterwards that it was the most hectic day of his life. And he couldn't believe that there were other young guys who were doing this kind of thing day after day after day. So anyway, Chris Cox became a publisher, and he published quite a lot of books about Rhodesia, including Winds of Destruction. And I asked Chris Cox one day the question as to whether the Selous Scouts killed the most blacks in the war. And Chris Cox wrote back to me and he said to me, no, he's quite certain that the biggest killing machine in the Rhodesian military was the Rhodesian Air Force. And after going through Winds of Destruction, I must tell you, there's no question about it. So nobody ever comes and says that the Air Force with 1,000 men, or let's say 1,000 staff, was the greatest killing machine in the Rhodesian military. But when you study it more closely, you'll see that it is so. And that, of course, is what those blacks were saying. The blacks who were on the receiving end were saying, yeah, the thing that really killed them, Air Force. So I thought I'd just mention that here. But I will tell you that I actually remember this business of the 70% of the kills coming from the Selous Scouts, because I remember it actually coming over the radio. They actually said it on the radio. The government said it. And it was said in the final days of Rhodesia, right near the end. And suddenly, just out of the blue, they have this news item and they say that the Selous Scouts are responsible for 70% of all the deaths during the war. And it was a very strange thing. That's all they said. They didn't talk about the Air Force. They didn't talk about the rest of the army. And in a way, it's kind of a kick in the teeth for everybody else who was fighting. And in the years afterwards, when I was in South Africa and all these guys began writing books, everybody quoted this same figure. And I think in some of the books, they even say that this was announced by the Rhodesian government. But I've sat back and asked myself, why did the Rhodesian government say such a thing? Why did they come out with this weird statement? And they just said it on the radio. Everyone heard it. The blacks would have heard it too, because the blacks also listened to the radio. And it doesn't give anybody else much credibility. And over the years, I've sat and thought about this. And I think I know the answer. This is a guess, but I think this guess is correct. I think that the Rhodesian government said this as a form of psychological warfare. I think that they said this because at the time that they were saying this, it wasn't long before the war was wound up and everybody would be going home. And remember that half of the Zulu scouts were black. So by saying this, it now has a psychological impact on the blacks, because the Zulu scouts were very secretive. And by saying this kind of thing, it could start making the blacks paranoid. And if somebody dies, they might wonder, are the Zulu scouts still active? Is this normal? Was this some kind of Rhodesian thing, even though it's after the end of the war? I think that it had a psychological value, and that's why they said it. And the actual kills of the Zulu scouts might not in any way be that number. But for psychological effect on our enemies, it's good to let them think the Zulu scouts might still be functioning in some way. And maybe it'll make them paranoid, and maybe it'll make them even kill other blacks. There could be all kinds of weird stuff that comes out of it. So I think that that announcement, that strange announcement, that there was an ulterior motive to that. There was some other ulterior motive. And I think psychological warfare is the only sensible explanation. So let me just return a little bit to a few final points about these blacks. As I've said, all these other people only respect strength. And notice with von Letau Vorbeck, where these blacks are calling him Bwana, where they are looking up to him, calling him father, and they've even said, if we can't follow you, our sons will follow you. So these blacks are clearly very impressed with excellence and success, and they are willing to follow von Letau Vorbeck into the future because he is a sign of success. Now, these blacks, all of them, they will respect us when we are strong and determined and excellent and can beat them. But you must understand, and this is something that I don't think von Letau Vorbeck or other Rhodesians and even South Africans, like the commander of 32 Battalion, that those people aren't grasping the obvious fact that these blacks are fair weather friends. When these blacks see that we're too strong, we're invincible, they can't beat us, then they become friendly. And they do it because they have no choice. So then they become friendly and they'll do anything that we tell them to do. But it's because we've shown we are strong and we are the boss. But the moment that we're not the boss, they'll turn on us. And that is why I've asked Rhodesians and I've said to them, okay, so you say the blacks and the RAR were on our side, the blacks and the Zulu scouts were on our side, but what did they do for us after the war? And the answer is nothing. They went and they became part of black society. Some of them were even promoted and off they went. And now they were loyal to their people. Another thing that people don't realize, especially in the case of South Africa and Rhodesia, is that these blacks are being paid. They're being paid a decent salary. And the salary that they're getting in the military, with all the special extras that come with it, is a salary that is far better than the average black was getting in the country at the time. So of course, those blacks are quite happy. They're getting, by their standards, big money and benefits. And although it's warfare, for them, it's like a well-paying job. And in the case of a thing like 32 Battalion in South Africa, I'm sure they were even better paid than the Rhodesians paid the Zulu Scouts. And so whites forget that we're giving these blacks higher salaries, higher other things that they would not get otherwise in the society of the time. And for them, it's like a cushy job where they are earning good money and they're on the winning side. But when you later lose, they're not on your side anymore. They might still be a little bit friendly to you, but they're not going to go out of their way for you. Then you are on your own. As all the whites discovered after Rhodesia and after Zimbabwe, when they did the farm seizures, that when this is all over and you lose, those blacks are not coming to help you. You're on your own. That is where the races finally part company. So don't be fooled by all this liberal talk. And I think von Letter Vorbeck also perhaps didn't realize the social status that the blacks got by being with him, being on a side like that. And they must have had many things that they got despite the hardship. If life was too hard for those blacks, if those blacks truly felt that life was way too hard, they would have just defected from him. Von Letter Vorbeck didn't have the means to go and hunt them down and shoot them if they defected from him. So I must tell you that all these whites who turn around and say, oh, but you know, they fought so well, they were so loyal, they were with us. You know what? It was only because we were strong and they were benefiting from being on our side. The reality is that when it's over, when we've lost, they are going back to their side. That's how it is. So they are fair weather friends only when you are strong. And you'd better see to it that you stay strong. That is why you cannot equate the issue of whites sticking together with each other to this issue of, ah, we got some good blacks and they're on our side. It's the same with the Jews, okay? It's the same with the Jews and everybody else. The only reason that they are on our side at this point in time is because they're getting benefits. Jews are living in America because they're getting benefits. America is an awesome place to be. So while it's an awesome place, they want to be American citizens. But when America is not such a cool place, they're going to be the hell out of there. But white Americans will still be living there and will see no reason to want to leave, no matter how bad things are. Why? Because the whites are loyal to the land, loyal to the nation, loyal to the country. So keep these things in mind, because the white conception of loyalty is completely different to this other stuff that you see from all the others. And I'm sure the same thing happens in the United States military with the non-whites, that when they fight, it's really a half-hearted fight. It's nothing like when the white guys fight. For them, life in America is just an easy place to live. But for the whites in America, America as a concept has value. So yeah, you can impress everybody, but you must be strong, you must be determined, and you must show what you're made of. And if you do, there will be no further discussion about all kinds of other rubbish. When you are the winner, when you are the boss, when you command respect, they will not come to you and say, oh, but we're equal to you. They won't do that. When you're the boss, they'll do whatever you say. And white men need to learn the art of commanding and leading, and the art of commanding respect. This is a thing that mostly comes out of the military. The military is the place where this kind of thing is truly born, time and again. In the military, ultimately, it boils down to ability. And white men need to learn certain skills. But when you have those leadership skills, when you are able to command and show and be strong, then you won't have to tolerate any of this other rubbish. All of this other garbage, all these goofballs who tell you they want to be equal, when they see you're the boss, they'll know you're the boss. And whatever law you lay down, they know that they will have to accept it. And that's that. When I look at past history, there are so many times when you can clearly see the power that whites had. And that is true even in more recent times. Even 120 years ago, the white race as an entity was an amazingly powerful thing. And the white race did not run around begging and pleading things from everybody. And nobody was arguing with the white race about equality or anything. 120 and more years ago, the white race was the boss. It was the boss virtually everywhere. You know, von Lettow Vorbeck went and fought in the Boxer Rebellion. The Boxer Rebellion was basically the Western world plus America deciding to go into China and go and kick somebody's ass. That in a nutshell. So the Boxer Rebellion was a rebellion against foreign exploitation, and the response was an eight-nation alliance of Britain, Japan, Russia, Germany, France, America, Italy, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So apart from the Japanese, it was basically the Western world going into China and clobbering them for attacking foreigners. And this was in 1900. Can you imagine that being done today? And at such a distance from Europe, there are many, many examples where you will see that whites in the past were much, much stronger, even in Christian times, even in modern colonial times. But we were at our strongest in ancient times. In ancient times, we knew how to be the boss. So supremacy is not a problem. Supremacy is the thing we should be doing to our utmost everywhere.
Gentlemen.
Thank you very much for listening today. I hope that you learned something new today. Look after yourselves and take care. We'll be chatting again soon.
Give up, my friend. If you don't see the end, if you don't see the top, don't stop. We know you'll win. Every fight, you'll fight, every game.